My guest today is Vincent A. Alberano, and he's joining me on Newton Talks to discuss his new book, Aesthetic Deviations, a critical view of American shot-on-video horror between the years 1984 and 1994, and that's published by Head Press. And if you're interested in buying the book, please go to the link that I've placed in the description. Vincent, thanks for joining me today. I really appreciate you giving me the time. I'm a big fan of the book. Can you tell the listeners exactly what you mean by shot-on-video horror and something about the time period you're looking at and the cultural context of these films?
Yeah, absolutely. So the whole era of the shot-on-video horror came out with basically the invention of the camcorder, which various developments, you know, from the 30s onward. But in the 1980s, around the early 80s, is when it was commercially available. Anyone could afford it, even though it wasn't exactly cheap. And there was this kind of commercialization of that technology. And just as 8mm and Super 8 film had done decades before, that kind of put it in the consumer's hands. And as that decade, the 1980s, progressed, there was this sense of, especially fans, hobbyists, amateurs especially, that they had the means, they could do it themselves. So just the definition of shot on video is analog video, whether camcorder or Betacam or any early video technology used to shoot a featurette or feature length film. And 82 is when the cycle, as I call it in the book, kind of started. And that's when titles started coming out. 84 to 94 is the period I focused on, which is just, there was this huge outgrowth, which coincided with VCRs likewise becoming commercially available. They were proliferating in homes across the globe. So it wasn't a restrictive technology anymore. And the 80s were interesting because the major studios were slow to cash in on VHS as a viable format. They thought that there were copyright issues, and there are a number of court cases I kind of briefly detail in the book. And that was the holdup, which opened the flood for all of these small distributors and one-offs even to start releasing low-budget films, re-releasing with different titles and art. And teenagers, families, a bunch of family men, even are part of the shot on video wave, would rent something that didn't quite live up to the box art or the promise and be like, well, I could do better in my own backyard. And that impetus is kind of where a lot of this and where a lot of my interest came from, is when the people made good on that thought and released their own visions.
So, you talk a little bit about the look of shot on video horror. On part two, you talk about this, it's got a distinctive aesthetic. Can you just explain a little bit about what that aesthetic is and why it might be off-putting to some people?
Yeah, so the distinctive aesthetic is just born of the analog video itself, because unlike celluloid, which at the point these films were coming out had almost a century of history, people had become accustomed to viewing 24 frames projected in the illusion of motion. Video is close to 30 frames, like 29.97. And those extra frames kind of add this almost jarring, it feels unreal, but it's closer to real life. So the motion seems faster. It's almost blurry because we haven't been accustomed as long to seeing that. And of course, video, it doesn't have the same chemical process that film does. So the colors are really garish in a lot of ways. There's pixelation, the image blurs, and you get the bleed from the colors since they're not really setting exposure. Nothing is orchestrated in the way that film is. And that's why the common thing thrown against these movies is that they look like home movies. And I was born in 1992, so I still grew up in an era where VHS and analog video camcorders were used for, you know, recording birthday parties and small events like that. And home movie footage is just what things shot on videotape specifically conjure. So I think it's off-putting for a lot of people to see something that's just so unvarnished and presented. And again, looks like a birthday party that they've been to or someone's wedding recital. And I think that's part of the trouble, in addition to just the fact that video was never really intended for any kind of commercial purpose, at least beyond, you know, Betacam or the higher end things that soap operas and the news were being shot on, but amateurs didn't have access to that technology in most cases.
So it starts out, the technology is really for kind of almost utilitarian purposes, right? It's for the practicalities of recording rather than expressing, I suppose, and that's the distinction we're not used to, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. And then there's also, I talk about it briefly in the introduction, but even before the shot on video horror films came out, people were making obviously amateur pornography. So there's that other kind of context that becomes associated with it. And whether that carries over culturally or not, there's that kind of illicit nature that I think people read into it as well, because it does look grubby and grimy and like private moments that you aren't meant to see broadcast on a screen.
And this is before the kind of boom in what we'd call now found footage that kind of uses the limitations of the format to make it look to make it look as if it's shot on video. They're not trying to hide the fact in a found footage movie the format that it's shot on. So these films are replicating mainstream films and things that are shot on film stock.
Yeah, exactly that.
You mentioned on one of the, again, early pages, I'm quoting your own words that you hear, Vincent. These are terrible, hideous-looking movies. and I'm just asking a question. Is there a beauty to any of them? Or is the ugliness part of the appeal? What's your take on that?
Yeah, so I realize reading that, hearing it, it sounds like a slight, but I do mean that affectionately, because there is a beauty in just how, whether it's how little thought or how small the means were behind it, because the visual image and everything that comes into that aesthetic, it's something that can't be offered even in, you know, lower budget B films shot on celluloid. So those that the director I talk about in the book, Charles Pynion, used the quote, aesthetic pugnacity. That is kind of endemic to the entire style of filmmaking. And I think that's why it sets itself apart. So the ugliness is a beauty in that way.
And does this ugliness, or in what ways does this ugliness manifest in other aspects of these movies? So I'm thinking in terms of the narratives, the kind of narrative incoherence, maybe the level of acting, which you mentioned quite a few times in the book. Can you talk a little bit about that? So it's not just necessarily in the actual the physical materiality of the video. It's also maybe this ugliness expresses itself in other ways too. Would you say?
I would say, yeah. The obvious component to the visual element is the audio, because a lot of these were recorded just with an in-camera microphone, so it's really distorted or blown out. There's no nuance to the sound being recorded. That's definitely an area that it suffers in almost across the board. And yeah, just as the home movie kind of analogy always works, the cast and crew weren't trained by and large. So these are just people pulled off the street or family and friends who happen to be around. And they're giving, in a lot of cases, you assume, are unrehearsed, uninformed performances, likely for the first time in their life, especially on front of a camera. So there's a kind of shakiness that blends with that lack of visual finesse down to the performative elements, the technical elements. You mentioned the found footage comparison, and in like the found footage films, you know, a shaky handheld camera is an aesthetic, you know, touch. In a lot of the shot on video works, that's just a mistake that made it in. So that's also part of the whole package you get.
And I'm guessing these films were, I'm calling them films, movies, films. I'm using the term interchangeably here, but that's something you talk a little bit about in the book as well. Maybe we'll come back to that. This idea that they're maybe not even considered as films at all, right? But I'm guessing that they're edited, it's linear editing, I'm guessing, for most of this as well.
A lot of it, especially early on, definitely was. Yeah. And then later on, as higher end video equipment became easier to come by, and it wasn't, you know, you have to have a job at the local news station to get access, then there was a little bit of branching out from that. But the early attempts, definitely.
Yeah. Which, of course, is going to mean more mistakes, kind of a looseness to the editing. You mentioned particularly the early ones. Have a certain, the early ones, the ones that you're looking at around kind of 82 to 84, 85, have this kind of, they have lots of long takes or entire dialogue scenes shot in wide shot for an entire, it feels primitive. And maybe the kind of lack of ability to edit really, really quickly is part of that as well, or do fast cutting is part of that as well.
Yeah. And in a later chapter on the Polonia Brothers Splatter Farm, I use an anecdote they share where they said they were such amateurs, even though they'd been making Super 8 films as teenagers and were used to shooting for their limited means on film, that when they did a dialogue shot, reverse shot, they would film one character, give their lines, stop the camera, move to the other position, and film the next one. So it was just in camera and linear like that. They didn't realize you could shoot the whole scene with coverage and then get your reverse take.
So it's like they're kind of learning as they're producing these things, you know.
Definitely, yeah.
And there's I suppose they're being made as well in a time of less media literacy. Mm-hmm. So people have far less of an ability to understand how to put movies together or how, you know, how a sequence might be edited. You talk a little bit about the shot on video movies being a parallel universe to kind of mainstream horror, and you cite as alternatives Evil Dead and Reanimator and things like that, but that's kind of another level of alternative, isn't it? Because Evil Dead and Reanimator were also critically reviled, and, you know, by mainstream critics at the time, so we're kind of like almost two levels down or three levels removed from this kind of mainstream, is what we would call it.
Yeah, it's very subterranean. I know the term comes up a few times in the book and in later chapters, especially. It's subterranean, but not necessarily underground, since it's like you were saying, a third tier of commercial cinema, because we have the Friday the 13th and the slasher series. And that was, you know, a big influence for a lot of these, especially the younger filmmakers working. And then there's the independent films that were still able to make a commercial impact, like Reanimator and Evil Dead, even if the critical component wasn't there necessarily. And then the shot on video, it's a weird underworld almost, where the influences from those other waves are being synthesized. And by all admissions, most of these things should never have been seen in the first place, and there's a whole range of obscurities out there. But because of the commercial marketplace at the time, they were released direct to video. Stores were buying them and stocking them. You could rent them next to the mainstream titles. So they were almost coexisting, even as far as they felt removed from it, and were certainly of a lower profile.
So on that, I'm going to quote more of your words back at you here, Vince, just because I think it's quite a nice quote and a nice way of starting to think about how these films relate to other forms of genre cinema and exploitation culture and exploitation cinema in particular. You write, Many of these films operate in ways that are distinct from other forms of cinema, even the exploitation works that immediately presaged and influenced them. So in what ways are these operating in distinct ways from the films that influenced them, apart from being shot on video?
Yeah, so obviously a lot of it, I think, comes down to the limited means they have. You can only do so much with an effects budget of $50. And when you either aren't old enough to drive yourself to get, you know, more ambitious things for your craft, or if you just don't know how to construct that. So one example I think of that kind of deals with those predecessors and brings it into the shot on video wave is a filmmaker, Nick Miller, who I talk about briefly in there. And he was pretty known in the 70s. He made several 16 and 35 millimeter exploitation films that played the drive-in circuit, the grindhouse theaters. And they're still really strange, kind of muted regional films, but because of the format they're shot on and seeing them broadcast in a theater or even at home, you know it's shot on film, it plays differently. Whereas if you look at the films that Nick made in the 1980s, Dr. Bloodbath is the one that stands out. There's a sort of disconnect where even within his own filmography, you can see how many miles and paces this is apart. Because Criminally Insane, the big title of his film shooting era, the effects are not great and convincing, but they work, just blood splatters. By Dr. Bloodbath, which deals with illicit abortion by an insane doctor, he's stabbing a plastic baby doll with a butcher knife. And somehow the camcorder format capturing that, it's ridiculous, of course, because you look at it and nobody would buy it for a second. But there's something about using that with video specifically where it feels that he and the entire kind of production movement that he's a part of has stepped into this different era where the rules are rewritten and what couldn't have been gotten away with shooting on film somehow was either permissible or excusable through the video format.
And would you say part of that is because the video format makes it look so home movie that it almost makes it look harmless in a way?
Yeah, but there's also a flip side to that, I think, where the baby doll is clearly harmless because what he's depicting, stabbing, you know, an infant or a fetus with a butcher knife would be unimaginably horrifying, but it's almost comical when he does it so crudely. And then there are other films in the cycle, like Video Violence comes to mind, where these acts of violence being represented aren't necessarily any more convincing, and in some cases aren't, but because of this illicit, almost video image, they manage to be disturbing in a way that fake-looking gore shot on film wouldn't be also.
Thank you. So where were these movies distributed, and could filmmakers make money off of these? What sort of budgets are we talking about? I think you at the top end, they seem like extraordinarily high budgets for the kind of returns that they would be getting. Can you talk a little bit about that, the budgets and what the business of marketing these films was?
Yeah, and the market and economic side is kind of why I chose the 1984 to 1994 span that I did. Because early on, the budgets, I think, Black Devil Doll from Hell, one of the early infamous ones that was also independently distributed, but widely so. I think $10,000 was the budget, which that's a respectable, reasonable budget, especially shooting on video for a first-time filmmaker. And I think there were at least a few thousand tapes made, and this is back in the era when, you know, even sell-through tapes for stores were over $50 and higher. So there were returns, and a lot of the goal was to break even or at least start financing the next round. Throughout the 80s, as more independents and amateurs took over, budgets just varied widely. A lot of them aren't documented. I know the Polonia brothers said that Splatter Farm, their debut release was made for $100 just because they had all their gore props, they had their location, they used family and friends as actors, so it was just cost of tapes maybe and additional fake blood. But that film got picked up by one of the, not major, but more known distributors, Donna Michelle, and it did, you know, make it into stores, it sold. I don't know, you know, the particulars of the licensing deal, but there was a commercial sense and there was that idea that there would be returns on the things that were made. Getting into the 90s, that kind of dried up because just like at the start of the talk, I said people would rent the movies and watch it and be like, that was terrible. And the stores started to get wise to what they were carrying and realizing that an attractive film box didn't necessarily mean good product. So that's when it kind of went more underground. And a lot of those films were made on weekends for $1,000 here, $1,500 there. But what set that apart is that with the restricted commercial access and video stores not being a figure as much, they were selling directly, whether at conventions or through fanzines or trading. So they kind of did, even if it was to a smaller audience, take control of the economic side in their own hands.
Yeah, I was. That's really glad you said that, because that was going to be my next question. Is about the importance of the fanzines to marketing these films, to creating a buzz around these movies, or at the very least being the place where they would be visible. So how important was that kind of zine culture, and also the catalogs that some of them would be sold through? Can you tell me a little bit about that surrounded these movies?
Yeah, so obviously, like I said, I was born in 1992, so I was born amidst this entire thing happening. So all of the work I've done with research and that is retrospective and through my own, as I collect fanzines for research purposes. But you read them now, 30 years removed, and there's this kind of amazing sense of this homegrown network. Like the big titles were Draculina from Hugh Gallagher, J.R. Bookwalter at Alternative Cinema, and then it kind of bridged the broader underground world and the horror world, but Film Threat Video Guide, which was a massive thing because you could find any independent films made on video, Super 8, 16 millimeter there. And there's also this dialogue between the magazines where you have the letters that are sent in by filmmakers, you have comments and editorials where they either, you know, make jokes about something that another magazine or distributor did. People write in and take issue with reviews that they read either in said publication or in another one. And that could be the filmmakers themselves, you know, clapping back, or fans disputing it. So there's this sense, even at the slower pace that, you know, monthly or quarterly publications would be, that there's an ongoing communication and that there is this active network. And then there's also, I mentioned it briefly, it's something that's fascinated me, this more obscure magazine, Independent Video, that ran briefly out of upstate New York. And that's the one where filmmakers themselves were asked to submit pieces, whether it's detailing how special effects worked on their shoot, or how they funded, or how they actually got to filming and on-set diaries. And it gives this platform where they can express the trials and tribulations of being a filmmaker while also saying, we need to sell this, we're trying to break even. If anybody's looking to distribute, are you willing to, you know, take a chance based on this short essay you read? And I also should mention that the three earlier magazines, Draculina, Film Threat Video Guide, and Alternative Cinema, were kind of packed up in their own distribution businesses as well. And that helped disseminate a lot of the films. A lot of people got work through that, and it continued in that way as well. So not only was there this dialogue in the pages of the publications, but there was an actual component to getting the films released that the magazines themselves fostered.
So with that in mind, then, going back to this idea of the kind of exploitation kind of culture, like market that they maybe tapped into, and combining it with the kind of zine culture that was happening, and as you said, the kind of chat back that you would get between, almost a kind of dialogue develops between filmmakers and fans, and vice versa. Was there did this lead to a temptation to create particular types of content? So were some of the more extremely violent ones, were they kind of pushed to do that for commercial reasons, or is it based on kind of artistic expression? I already know the answer to that. It's often a bit of both, right? With any ask those.
Yeah.
But to what degree was the violence pushed because of the zine culture, if that makes sense?
Yeah, the best example I can think of where that is true, it's only briefly mentioned in Aesthetic Deviations, the book. There's an image of Mike Johnson's film, Tortured Soul 2, which is the sequel to this very explicit and mean-spirited and graphic slasher he made. And Film Threat reviewed it, and it was, the end of the review was, God forbid, Tortured Soul 2. And when that review was published, Mike said, like, we started getting a flood of orders coming to us because of that. So of course we're going to make Tortured Soul 2, and it's going to be even more what they were deriding in the review. So there was that kind of game of chicken being played too. And the other good example is Todd Sheets, who wrote a whole chapter on in this. His infamous film of that period was Goblin, which was so graphically violent that his distributor basically wouldn't release it, which in direct-to-video, shot-on-video horror as a economic premise is kind of shocking to hear. So there was the sense that what was being written and said and seeing what other people were working on and how it was received kind of did nudge, as the 90s progressed especially, towards more extreme content.
And I've seen a bit of those clips, and but because they avoid that kind of what would you call it, a kind of realism or kind of verisimilitude, would you say there's still a that it doesn't appear to be terribly disturbing, unlike some kind of later iterations, like the, I think you mentioned it very, very briefly, like the Fred Vogel's August Underground series, which are, I don't think you can still get in the UK. You'd have to order it, online. Is there a kind of comparison there, or how do they compare with something like that?
Yeah, that's something that's always kind of fascinated me with the nastier, more vicious kind of movies, because like I said earlier, with video violence, and then there's Las Vegas Bloodbath is another one. They're fairly crude in the actual work of the effects, and what we're seeing, we know, are pretty cheap props and weren't elaborate considerations. But there's also this idea behind it where the inception of that idea to do something so horrific as Las Vegas Bloodbath, having, you know, a fetus ripped out and thrown around a room, even if the means to realize it aren't there, there's still that conception. And that kind of proves disturbing in its own right, that it was thought of as such a fully formed idea, was realized so ineptly, but still captured on this grimy, illicit looking visual format. So there's kind of a jarring disconnect where even those more fake and embarrassing looking things still can disturb because the idea was there.
You write a lot in the book about the links to film realism, surrealism, and also connections between these shot on video movies and the avant-garde. Maybe that's a bit too much to ask you to speak about all of that in one go. And if you can start talking about that and how these things relate to the avant-garde, to the ideas of film realism, and the Surrealists as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So starting with realism, because that's sequential with the book, it was one of the first things to click for me that these are often filmed, as I've said, with friends and family members and people who have never acted. So they're not giving performances so much as we know that we're watching people recite lines in front of a camera. It pulls back that kind of layer. And in the earlier films especially, but even down the line, locations were often limited to someone's living room or their home. And very little, if anything, was done to retouch it for the camera or stage it as a set. So that's where the home movie connection sticks with me. And it really does, in a lot of senses, bring you into this world as it existed at the time of filming. It was a theoretical hole I didn't want to go down, and it's not where I focused on in my own studies, but there is this very strong sense that you're watching a genuine working class kind of cinema unfold, and it's made with the means that were available to these people. So that's where the realism hooked in for me. As far as the surrealism, that's something that comes up in a lot of writing on SOV movies, and a lot of it is just review based or shorter features, where those kind of technical and aesthetic disconnections and lapses in judgment that are so widespread in this almost kind of to represent this idea of surrealism or just the bizarre or a dream logic. But just with the academic background I'd had and things I'd read, I thought it was interesting to bring direct quotes in these examples, like the chapter on Todd Cook's Demon Doll specifically, that's shot in his own home. He's playing a version of himself, as is his wife, and they're basically going through their everyday routine, but there are these jarring kind of inserts and deviations that line up with a lot of the surrealist theory I was familiar with at the time about common everyday objects and life and the way that they interact. And that's where the estrangement comes from. So I kind of wanted to get down on paper these specific connections and show, even more than just comments about it, that it was very much embodying that sense, even if it was unconscious at the time of production. And then with the avant-garde, that's the specific films I chose for that chapter, Carl Sekenick's Alien Beasts and Charles Pynion's Twisted Issues. I think those just very blatantly were formal experiments brought on screen. They do a lot to mess with spatial and temporal engagements on the spectator's behalf. They do some really strange things just with fracturing the narrative, bringing subconscious sensations on screen and representing those worlds of their characters. But I think more broadly, just with shot on video horror itself, there's this sense, whether it's unintentional and from the hands of amateurs, but this very tenuous grasp on the basic mechanics of cinematic creation. And I think in a lot of ways that itself becomes its own innovation. And that's where this experimentation comes from, is trying things that somebody who was better informed or had experience never would have thought to do, and forging this new approach to making a movie as a result.
Just so I'm clear in my mind, Twisted Issues, who's the director of that again?
Charles Pynion.
Charles Pynion. And that's the one with the skate people.
Yes.
Yeah. So that's got almost kind of crosses those kind of boundaries between the kind of realism and surrealism, right? So he's kind of skate friends, right?
Yeah.
That he makes this with in the kind of streets of whatever town he's from. But you've also got these kind of inserts where you described the film. Well, I've seen a few scenes in that where where he's some of the murders are told in a very kind of interesting way, and I think the as you say, those kind of, they're almost interruptions of this otherwise real narrative that's happening.
Yeah, and Twisted Issues is interesting because it was a documentary function. He was in Gainesville, Florida at the time, and the end of that year was moving to New York City. And he said in interviews that the basic impulse was to capture this music scene, these friends, this life I was living, and document it because nobody else would. And I know that a lot of that project was very collaborative, so everybody brought in more ideas. But the murder scenes and things you're talking on are like the scenes where Charles casts himself as this almost omniscient character holed up in his house. He's watching television the entire time, but scenes that we watch in the diegesis of the film's narrative are playing on his television, and he's kind of engaging and interacting, commenting on them, and seeing them unfold from this different perspective. So there's almost this interesting kind of handling of the mediation and the way that that's represented, and just the very video format itself and how it plays into it.
Doug, can you say something about any potential ironic readings of these films, and which is something you avoid in this book, and you make a very clear point about avoiding ironic readings and that kind of so bad it's good understanding of film.
Yeah,
can you say something about that?
Yeah, it's just a sensibility that even as I've grown up immersed in low budget and cult and exploitation films, never really clicked with me, whether that's, you know, the mystery science theater means of cracking jokes throughout it or laughing because things don't proceed or aren't accomplished the way that we expect them to be or that the filmmakers were hoping they would. And the thing that kind of crystallized that approach for me was the, obviously it's a classic book now, but the Research Incredibly Strange Films volume, where in the introduction they say, these films operate in ways that if you just bear with them, unlock this completely new world, and they exist on their own terms. And I think that is the phrase that was really key for me, is meeting the films and filmmakers on their own terms, because even in the most ridiculous scenes like the Chester Turner Black Devil Doll and Tales from the Quadhead Zone, where they're very almost juvenile in the way they're constructed and none of the effects come off as they should, there's not really any value in just laughing at it so much as seeing the realistic elements unfold, seeing what he was trying to attempt, learning the context that he was more impacted by like the Universal monster films, and having that sound like I'm talking down, but like an adult perspective brought to filmmaking, where even if the realization is inept, recognizing what was attempted, what was being attempted, and what was happening behind the scenes, even if it didn't manifest on screen, that's more interesting than just the easy out of laughing and having a good time with it, because there's something about these movies that sticks with you, and I wanted to get closer to why that is.
Yeah, and so with that then, I think that it's difficult to put your finger on exactly why that is, and why these films are kind of why they do tend to draw you back. And there seems to be something quite hypnotic about some of them, and their kind of mode of address is it's absolutely true. I mean, one of my favorite, I don't think you touch on it in the book, is Scooter McRae's Shattered Dead, which I would say is genuinely a great piece.
Absolutely.
Great film. And in some respects, doesn't fit in necessarily with some of the other films that you're looking at. But obviously, it's if you're not used to the way that those films are going to look, or the way that it speaks to its audience, or the way that it creates, it structures its narrative, then it could be off-putting. But I think it's a genuinely great work of art.
Yeah.
With that in mind, would you say there's a kind of canon of these films, notable films that listeners should go and either check out, or whether they're good, or whether they're because they're really good examples of what you're referring to?
Yeah, for a couple of reasons, I think a lot of the films I discuss in the book have become the canon. Not that I'm saying I asserted them as such, but there are a couple of reasons for that. This began as a MA graduate studies project, so I needed the research component. Those are the films with material available to research, whether written or trade advertisements, things like that. And then also it comes down to the films that are available, widespread, whether DVD or Blu-ray. But yeah, that's kind of where I zeroed in on. So let's see if I can keep this chronological, but going through a canon. The opening shot is Boarding House, John Windergate's film, which is the only one of these that played in theaters across the country in the U.S. on celluloid, because they transferred the Beta video to 35 millimeter, which is crazy process to think of now. Then I'd say Chester Turner's Black Devil Doll from Hell, because it was an early film. It's one of very few, throughout the 80s at least, completely funded, financed, produced, and distributed, and starring an African-American cast and crew. And it also hits just absolute depths of bad taste that need to be seen to be believed. Say,
that sounds good in and of itself.
Right. I'm not fond of it, but Blood Cult was kind of the inciting film for a lot of these. That's the one with a massive push behind it. It made it all across the country in video stores. And as a lot of these directors have said, that's the one they rented and say, I could do better than that. So Blood Cult is good as an inciting incident. Gary Cohen's Video Violence, that's another major title. It's another one of the really successful films from that original wave. And it's interesting because it's set entirely in this world of suburban video stores and the role of the camcorder and how that plays in. I think those are like the major, major titles. If I could make my own canon, I would move into the 90s more. And Charles Pynion's second film, Red Spirit Lake, is, I think, one of the most impressive shot on video features of any wave. It's very extreme in content. It has an experimental approach and a lot of thematic depth that, as extreme as it is, there's a lot of statements being made. That one, Todd Cook's Demon Dolls, I'm very fond of, I think more than a lot of people, just because it is naturalism brought on screen and very mundane at that. And something about that, like you said earlier, is hypnotic.
I don't know if you've got an answer to this, but because you don't deal with it in the book. But to what degree did this phenomenon cross to overseas, either with, let's say, these movies being available in other countries or other countries producing them? The two that I know were produced in the UK would have been Supper Little Children, which is a kind of like, I don't know if it was shot on VHS or something, like shot in a kind of children's home, for a kind of haunted children's home, which is now available on DVD. And also Cliff Twemlow's GBH, which I'm not sure you might have heard of or not.
I've heard of, but I've not seen.
Yeah, again, shot on video, and it's not a horror film. It's a kind of bouncers and gangsters and fighting and shoot 'em up type film. But yeah, did you get a sense of how these might have played in other countries, or any other countries that had their own versions of these?
Yeah, so it's actually something I am very interested in and have done some writing on to this point. Suffer Little Children is a great example, because that was very early. That was 1984, I believe. So this is when the cycle was just getting its footing. And I think that's a great example, because it is very haunting, and there's a very distinct kind of horror to it. So that's a great example of it. There are other UK productions I know of. Brian Davies is a filmmaker that made a handful in the UK that a friend of mine has written on for a zine. And there's also an interesting, there's an American filmmaker from Michigan that moved to the UK and directed his own films named Richard Baylor while living in the UK, and he's still there. And they're very experimental, but very dark, psychological kind of post-cinema of transgression horror. So there was a wave there. The other huge outpouring of this was countries like Germany, where filmmakers like Olaf Ittenbach and Andreas Schnass with the violent shit films that all became really infamous across the world, I think, after the censorship controversy they faced. But there's also this more subterranean world of just backyard gore films made in Germany and Norway. And they pop up online and they're fascinating, even when they don't hold up as a viewing experience, just because there is that grassroots network and you can see how it was spread. And part of why I limited my own focus to the US in this time period is, again, based on the resources I was able to locate and find myself. And I don't read German, of course, so I'm limited as much as I would love to dive into how those were disseminated and how people were in contact with each other. And then I'm not as qualified to speak on it, but in the UK specifically, you know, the BBFC and all of that wave going on, restricted access, films were spread more covertly than they would have been in the US. And a lot of the British zines and publications I've come across bring this more academic approach to the writing. I'm thinking Shock Express being the big one. They weren't concerned with amateur cinema that was kind of popping up. There was a more sociological point to what they were writing on and making bigger statements. So I just didn't really have as many resources to investigate that as fully as I would have liked.
So with that in mind, then, this would be the final question, because I think this will sum it up really nicely. Well, depending on how you answer anyway. For those who can't see, Vincent's laughing at that point, right? So I made that clear to the listener. So why is it important to examine these films in this period? And how have they been written about so far? Either academically, I get the sense these have been written about on the web by fans, and you know, that kind of zine culture being transposed onto the web, no doubt. I'm aware of a little bit of that myself. But how have they been written about so far? Is there any coherence to that? And why is it important to study this, do you think?
Yeah. So first part of why this is important is because deeper, more critical writing does not really exist on shot on video horror at this point in time. A lot of it, as you said, is fan-based or just hobbyist projects. They're largely reviews or just a longer type recap. There's no or very little critical analysis, textual examination that's going on. A lot of the reviews and like the more popular sites and books like the Bleeding Skull website and their books, there is some ironic sensibility brought to it, and it is still about having a good time as you read about these movies. But I think it's generally lacking in more considered film studies analysis, because before that, all there was is spotty fanzine coverage and then the publications we talked about earlier from the 90s, where it's very of the moment. It's not analytical. It's scene reports and set reports and things like that. So I think as 70s exploitation, 80s horror, and even the mainstream horror from the 90s and beyond have been brought into the academic canon more, there's still a lot of work to be done with the amateur and shot on video films, and that's part of the project there.
Vincent, thank you very much for giving me your time. I really enjoyed that.
Thank you so much. I had a great time.
That was Vincent Alboroni discussing his book, Aesthetic Deviations, A Critical View of American Shot-on-Video Horror, 1984 to 1994, published by Head Press. I want to thank Vincent again for giving me his time, and also thank Head Press for arranging this interview. Please go to the Head Press link in the description to order the book and to look at their other catalogue of work on cult film and cult media. And thanks to you for listening. Newton Talks will return.